So we always start, Penelope, just by asking the person we've invited to poetry just to talk about why they chose the two poems. So I'd be interested to hear why you chose The Rilke and The Graves.
Well, first I'd like to thank both readers for wonderful readings. I've chosen them because they're poems that struck me very early on in my reading and writing life choice. I'm not going to say career, life choice. The Graves was published in the TLS, and I think I was about 14 or 15, and I cut the poem out, and it was on my bedroom wall until it kind of faded away completely. And I just loved it always, because, funnily enough, Graves is a poet I admire and respect, but he's not actually a huge, massive favourite of mine, but I do love that poem, and it has stayed with me. It's quite stately. It's like a spell, and it said so much. I've always been fascinated by the moon and by weather, and I now, or I have since 1970, lived in a place that has plenty of weather in Cornwall, and it really bewitched me. And it was a few years after reading this, and I saw Graves read at one of the Poetry Olympics in the Albert Hall, and that kind of has stayed with me. And it's a poem I kind of forget about for ages, and then I come across it in an anthology, and or just when I'm just browsing and reading, and it still has that charge of what language can enchant. And also, of course, it's scientifically correct. The rain comes because the moon is tugging the tides first one way and then the other. And then the Rilke, I read, a friend of mine worked in a book, we were based at school, a friend of mine worked in a bookshop on Saturdays, and she would occasionally liberate a few books, and this was, perhaps people remember, or perhaps not, the Penguin Modern European Poets series, which came out in the 60s. And in fact, this is my name in it, my name in October 1964, so I was 17. And I'd never heard of Rilke until my friend gave me this book. And this is in the old translations, The Leishman, which I still do love, although, of course, he's been beautifully translated by David Young and many other people. And that, when I first read it, it spoke to me of a love affair. You know, at that age, one is sort of bouncy from one yearning love affair to another. And then over the years, as I've gone back to it, one realises he's right, it's the soul he's seeking, it's the muse he's seeking. Rilke had these long blocks of years when the muse turned her face away from him. And so this is an appeal, you know, to be so close but so far. It's the soul, the god, the muse. And I then, you know, in a way that there are not many poems, I don't think, that we'll read when we're very young that continue to be touchstones over one's whole reading and writing life. So when you asked me to choose two poems, they were it was really a simple matter, because I thought, yes, those two at the beginning were the ones.
Great. And in a way that leads us to talk, I'd like you to say a little bit, if you would, about your life, your family. So I was struck by your most recent volume, Sangrain and Hourglass. There's a lovely poem, for instance, about your father. There's a sequence of poems about your father, particularly about his experience in a prison of war camp. And there's a very touching poem about your mother. You also mentioned in the poem that your father wrote poems. So I just sort of wondered if you could introduce us a little bit to your family.
Really... My father died 6 months after Peter Redgrove, so my husband died, and 6 months later, Dad died. And in writing about him, I found there's one poem in there about him when he's an old man, and one when he's ill. But mostly I found it really difficult to write about him after he died, as an ailing elderly man. And it was going back to him as a young man that I was able to connect with him, and I felt that the elegy was, in telling his story of his war experience, as a way of mourning him in a way, you know, because, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of young men at 19, the war broke out in 39, he signed up, he'd already been in the Territorial Army, he signed up, and within 3 months, he found himself in Shanghai as part of the international There were four powers there, I think, holding Shanghai. Yeah. And seeing the Japanese on the other side with the bridge, but it was a stasis. So he was there at 19 or 20. And then from then he was transferred over to what were then the Malay states. And then real war started, shooting war. And the British forces were pushed all the way down to Singapore. Mm. And then came the fall of Singapore in February 42. And then my father became a prisoner of war, again, with thousands and thousands of British, Americans, Australians, Dutch. Mm. And was then spent until the end of the war, which the end of the war over Japan was the 16th of August 45, in jungle prisoner of war camps. And, yeah. and people have seen on TV the film The Bridge Over the River Kwai, which is an extremely cosmeticised version of what people suffered there, you know. Mm. And my dad had malaria, he had amoebic dysentery, he had tropical ulcers, but he survived. So that really influenced his whole, well, it coloured his whole life, you know. Mm. He came back, he was already engaged to my mother, they married, my brother and I were born, and life resumed normality. And although my dad said he always had one flashback at least every day of some traumatic event that happened, not necessarily to him but to other people, he actually didn't, perhaps it's the luck of the draw, he didn't suffer the kind of mental breakdowns and post-traumatic wartime stress. Well, he did, but in not such ways to disable him from living a worthwhile and valuable life to him and to us and work colleagues and so on. And he did write, but he did mostly write Valentine's and birthday poems for his sisters, whom he had five. But he was a great reader, and when he retired, finally, he didn't retire till he was about 73, he then went immediately to literature and poetry appreciation classes. So there's that link of poetry between us.
There's a touching story in the volume about your mother as well.
Well, my mum is going to be 90 in April, and you know, she's mentally alert, she's physically well, but she is very deaf, which comes into the poem. And she lost part of 50% of her hearing as a 3-year-old child from diphtheria, so that's been quite socially excluding. But I spend quite a lot of time at mum's, often passing through from one work thing engagement to another, and it's really strange that she would suddenly, just casually over the breakfast table, and it's just her and I there, tell me some memory from so far back that she's never spoken of to me before. And we were just talking this and that. Maybe we were talking about children. And she just began to tell me. I knew she'd been in this isolation hospital. I knew she'd nearly died from the diphtheria. And there was a huge epidemic in, I think, 1923. And she told me this about being in this isolation hospital for 16 weeks and then in convalescent hospital for so many other weeks in Windsor. And then she said, which is the sort of the core of the poem, that when she finally came home, she had to ask her mother, "Are you my mother?" Because she'd completely forgotten. And in those days, parents weren't welcome on the wards. Her mother, my grandmother, was unable to visit a lot of the time because she was actually expecting another child, so she she couldn't go into the diphtheria area. So you know, and why it's taken, why it took my mum to be 89 or 88 before she told me that extra, I mean, the extra detail, I don't know, but I'm glad she did.
Because, I was very, very struck by it.
And the poem is more or less a verbatim account of that, because you can't really decorate it. It is what it is.
And did poetry enter your own life through those poems that we've had read, or was there something before that? Was that moment when you saw it in the TLS, the grave? Was that the moment?
I'd always been reading poetry. We had a really ramshackle collection of books. Old. In fact, the first poetry I read was in old school textbooks that belonged to my mother's two elder sisters. And so they were very ancient, and they were full of little bits of Anon, and bits of Tennyson, and some of them had bits of Wilfred Owen and bits of Keats extracted. So I really read in an extremely unstructured and random way. And I suppose really preteens reading. I'm just one of these ghastly children who just start reading and go on reading. Can't be made to do anything else, really. So poetry was always there, and we were a house with books, you know. And then I suppose, and I came into my teens, and I again started reading in very unstructured ways through the public library system, you know. I remember discovering when I was about 15 or 16, the poems of a very strange poet who'd been a friend of D.H. Lawrence called Witta Binner. And it was just a book called New Poems. And they were the first time I'd come across surrealist poetry. And they were not very good surrealist poetry, but I'd been reading then poems like, in England there was a thing called The Movement, poems by Kingsley Amis and people like that. Incredibly boring. Oh, God, if this is what it is, the genteel English formal verse, which I thought, no, I can't possibly be a poet. And then I read this quite bad surrealism, but I realised you could just push the language to the envelope and push it, push it, and push it. About that time I also started to write. It's hard to remember exactly all one's read, because it's a long time ago.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You've been writing for 30 years now, haven't you? Something like that. And
being very kind.
Been writing for a sort of 30.
Let's call it 30.
My mother was 45 for so long.
Well, my daughter started taking a couple of years off her age.
Oh, really?
That's not good for me.
So, you've been writing for a long time.
Yes.
And I just wonder, you know, and you published 10 collections. How do you feel that your own writing has changed? And what has been the kind of catalyst for those changes?
I think sort of picking up from Rilke, he has this faith that you always are at the beginning. You know, you may have published 1, 10, whatever collections, but when you're there with the blank screen or the piece of paper or the rough notes on scribbled somewhere, you're always at the beginning, and it's as if you haven't published X or Y, you know, and that's very necessary to keep the energy fresh and lively. But I think probably two things in writing have changed, because one branch of it is if you like, mirrors my life experience. When I was had a very small child, the poems I wrote were about pregnancy, and then as she grew up, there was a poem about her as a teenager when she grows taller than me, and you begin the letting go. And at the same time, those poems, which are pure adventures in the imagination, you've spoken of the imagination, and that will take you, you don't know where that will go, and that comes into the area of Elizabeth Bishop's, the almost always more successful surrealism of everyday life.
You always
hear something more weird than you could have imagined, but then you bring the imagination in and you let the imagination just go with it. I've always liked improvising, I've always liked writing from chance and random prompts. So there's a lot of exploring, and that's always a new place to start from.
And part of your exploring seems to me to be, from what you said even earlier, is that living in Falmouth and the weather of Falmouth. In one interview you say that living in Falmouth has been and still is a constant spur and enlarger of my imagination. I'm just wondering how that is. When did you move there? How has Falmouth affected you in that way?
I moved there in 1970, so I've been there a long time. And I was born and brought up in Staines, so really very urban, apart from the river. It's an urban scape, really. And so our experiences of countryside, nature, a wilder thing, were a created landscape, Virginia Water, and the Windsor Park, we used to visit as children. And I was always really drawn away from the urban thing to nature, and a very significant thing was a holiday with my aunt when I was about 14 at Linton and Lindmouth, and I thought, I really want to be in the West Country. And then one of these curious things happened in life. I just happened to fall in love with someone who was living in Falmouth. And so, you know, I moved down there. But it's interesting, because not only is it countryside all around, though I live in a town. But it's a sea, and it's by the sea, and it's a port. So lots, although it's a smallish town, it's a lot of different towns. It's a university town, it's a port town, it's a bit of a fishing town, it's a holiday town, it's a walker's. It's doing lots of different things. Mm. And where I live is on a peninsula out of the town, and so you have this, you have the Fowell estuary going up there, and you have the sea that side. So Peter was used to feel very compressed by the pressure of the weather, and so and Charles Causley, the Cornish poet, always called Cornish weather resurrection weather. So it knocks you down and then it picks you up again. So that's sort of that whole climate weather fluctuation, change of mood. It's a very moody place, Cornwall. It's not always sunny and lovely. So that really is quite a challenge to imagination.
And of course, reading your volume Sandgrain and Hourglass, and the preceding volumes, Redgrove's Wife, and obviously one of the most striking things is the poems about Peter Redgrove, poems of mourning, poems of loss. So I thought it'd be good if you could introduce him to us, Peter Redgrove. Just, how did you meet him? There's some quite autobiographical poems in the volume, very striking ones. Did the poems draw you to him? Did he draw you to him? I mean, I'm not trying to tittle-tattle you.
I knew Peter's work because he was published an awful lot in the 60s when I was beginning to write and reading more and more. And he was a friend of Ted Hughes at Cambridge, and both at different colleges, but university there. He was a member of Philip Hobsbawm's The Group, which was the very first. Almost any workshop you go to in UK now will follow Philip Hobsbawm's workshop, a critical workshop, where poems are circulated, a poet reads a poem, and then keeps silent while everyone critiques, and the poet comes back in. And that was Philip Hobsbawm's model. He took it then from London, Cambridge, London, Belfast. Seamus Heaney was a member he went on to Glasgow. So I knew Peter as a member of the group. But the first time I heard his work was on Radio 3. It might even have been called the third programme then. Again, when I was in my teens, and he wrote a poem, a long poem called The Case, and it was for a voice artist called Roy Hart, who Peter had met. And it was a piece for radio, and it was very striking piece, and I turned on after it had started, so the radio, so I didn't know who'd written it, and I was convinced it was from an Eastern European poet who had been translated, and because Eastern European poets were very much coming in many in this series. Then it said Peter Redgrove at the end, and I thought, well, that's really fascinating and interesting, and I just filed it away in my mind. And then I was on holiday in Cornwall staying with friends, and Peter came over in St Ives, actually Zenna, just outside. Zenna is a little village just outside St Ives. And people I was staying with, they were putting together ideas for St Ives Festival, Poetry Festival. And Peter was on what was then called the Poetry Panel of the Arts Council, when there was actually a group of poets who were actually worked with the Arts Council giving bursaries to poets. You can only imagine that now. And so Peter came over, and they pitched the festival to him, and then he pitched it to this panel, and they got their funding. But Peter and I kind of really connected then. His marriage was finishing then. That was in the summer of 69, June. And then because of his marriage disintegrating, he didn't spend that summer in Cornwall. He spent it in Somerset, where I was living, and the relationship kind of really blossomed then. And then I moved down to Falmouth in February. But you will soon be able to learn a great deal more, perhaps, than you want to, about Peter's life, because on what would have been his 80th birthday, which is next January, the 2nd of January 12, Neil Roberts of Sheffield University will be publishing his biography. It'll be called A Lucid Dreamer. It'll be published by Cape. And it will also have a companion volume of the collected poems from Peter. I recommend this biography.
And in one of the interviews you mentioned Peter having a dream about Pound.
He had never met Pound, right, if only. If only, but he had met, curiously, he was living in Falmouth, a guy called John Layard, who was an anthropologist who wrote a book called The Stone Men of Malekula, an early and key text in anthropology. Mm. But he, John Layard, had studied with Homer Lane, studied psychotherapy with Homer Lane, who had studied with Jung, so it's like an apostolic succession. Mm. And John Layard had, he was a doctor, and he'd been in private practice as a psychotherapist, and Peter, when his marriage was failing, was in therapy with him. Mm. And then he went on to have what was then called a teaching analysis. Mm. And that was in the Jungian mode, dream interpretation, and Peter used those methods with the students he was teaching at Falmouth College of Art. Mm. And after he retired, took early retirement, he did actually have a therapeutic practice for some years. Mm. Mm. So he had a profound interest and an experience in psychotherapy and the Jungian mode. Mm. And that, of course, comes into The Wise Wound.
Mm-hmm. And he dreamt that the pound had died, didn't he?
Yes, he woke up over the breakfast table. He said, I dreamt someone came and whispered in my ear in my dream, Ezra Pound is dead. And then they announced it on the radio news. Mm. So that's one of those curious Jungian synchronicities.
Indeed, it is, yes. So, of course, the other thing that I'm aware of and that's come through the poems is I know that you were Peter's sole carer for 4 years, something like that.
Yeah.
Here at the London Buddhist Centre, we run carers' retreats, and we have been running carers' retreats for, I don't know, 10 years now. So I'm a little bit, and I've done some of carers' work myself, so I'm a little bit aware of the stress and, well, the enormous stress of caring. I wonder whether you're happy to talk a little bit about those years. I don't want to...
Really, for the years I was caring for Peter, because his decline really was quite long and slow, and he probably had Parkinson's in a dormant way a lot longer than before he was diagnosed, and it was masked by his type 2 diabetes. Mm. Carers have such an arduous task, and it's because of the feelings of love you have, and then seeing it's that clash between that and seeing someone become a different person that is so hard to bear, and it did grind me down dreadfully, and to the point that really 2002-2003, coming out of it in the early 2004, I actually have a kind of amnesia. It's kind of a black hole, because that's when I had a breakdown really, and I came back and was able to care for Peter, and then I had a breakdown. And my sense of time scale and things that happened really are lost to me. In fact, I've only remembered some things because a couple of close friends kept journals at the time, and actually I've had to ask them to look up things, when did this happen, when did that happen? Mm. And I think that is what the stress of caring does really wipe you out.
I mean, you can hardly leave the house.
You can't. You can't at all. Particularly, and the person you're caring for, you know, mobility is very poor. So if you do go out, you have to move very, very slowly. Mm. And also, the way it takes it out of you happens very slowly. So you don't actually notice until everything falls in. Mm. It's just a very, very hard thing to do. Mm. And also with many... Peter's ailments and many other people will have experienced this, is that you begin to experience bereavement before you lose a person to their dying, to their death, because you know this is going to happen, this is imminent, and that's very difficult to manage, so it's just a very hard time.
Mm. You had children at the same time. You had children... At the same time.
No, our daughter had left home. In fact, she'd been made redundant from a job. She was travelling in Spain and just on her way to Portugal when Peter was taken into hospital, and she came back then, and she was just a huge help. Mm. Then she stayed about 6 months in Cornwall after that.
I mean, the other thing that I wondered is whether, because again, I was very struck by the poems about Peter in the two volumes, and whether you started writing those poems in that period, they seem very fresh. They feel like it's very fresh, as it were. It's new to you, and yet, and I know it's a while ago now, but I wondered whether you started writing them then, or how you came to write some of these poems Peter.
There's quite an overlap between some of the poems in Sand Grain and Hourglass and Redrow's Wife. Mm. And in fact, the title for Sand Grain and Hourglass was originally The Repose of Baghdad, which is a poem I'll read in the reading time. But decided not to call it that because Baghdad carries so many other associations that are nothing to do with my association with it. Yes, yeah. And that poem was what I thought of as the first poem. It was written while I was still putting together the Redrow's Wife poems book. Mm. But I knew it had nothing to do with that, because I knew it was a phase two of loss. Mm. And the poem was written in Cordoba. And one of the things, my experience of loss was, when Peter died, that his presence went right out of the house. Mm. And when he went, he was gone. Whatever journey is there, he'd gone. Whereas other people's experience of loss is that the person they've lost is going to suddenly walk in the door and meet them in the street. So I never experienced that until I was in Cordoba, which is a place he and I had never visited together. And then I had almost strange hallucinatory feelings that we were going to meet. Mm. And, of course, you can't. You can only meet in the realm of the imagination. So that was the subject of the poem. We can't meet, but it starts in Cordoba and then it goes out to all the places we can't meet. And then I'd written this poem in handwriting. I came back to London and it was in a bag that was then stolen in a bookshop. And so I was so furious. You have to have. So I wrote it out again. So I've no idea what the very first poem was. But having got it, I thought, I can't put this in Redrow's Wife because it feels different to me. So that certainly was then the keystone of this book. And others were in draft. The poem about my dad's release from captivity and from the jungle prison camps, that was also written then, published in the Manhattan Review. But the poems that belong in one collection have an atmosphere. You can't really describe it, but they have an atmosphere that means they go in this collection, and others just have to wait their turn, even though it was actually a 5-year wait.
That's what struck me reading the two just recently, was that the two volumes do seem a little bit like a diptych to me. They felt like they've got things in common, they've got certain things different between them, but they felt like a diptych, like they could be.
I like that way of thinking of them and describing them. And there are so many, but also time, the element in Sand Grain and Hourglass, that's hence the time and the title. Yeah. It's the Redgrove's Wife poems about Peter and about loss were very immediate, and some were even taken from notes before he died when I felt bereaved, very scattered notes that I kind of went back to, and then they became a doorway into finding way of writing elegiacally. But then, as each month, each year goes on, you have very different feelings about loss, and a lot of that is to do with letting go and letting go. And in fact, in Redgrove's Wife, one poem is about letting go, but I was only at the very beginning of that process then. And so these poems go right up almost till 7 years. And a lot of them are what do you do about when memories are fading? How much can you hold on to and how much should you hold on to? And also, I was very struck by something Ted Hughes said in an interview after Birthday Letters, when he said writing poetry is a way of continuing to talk to someone, people, when it's too late. And there's lots of things you wish you had said when it's too late. We all have this. Yeah. And poetry is a way of saying that.
I mean, it's striking that in the current issue of Poetry Review that you've got a poem called The Seventh Year,
which was written on the 7th anniversary last year, 16th of June, which I found a very difficult anniversary because it seems to make such a long time. Seven years is such a long time. 7 years is such a magical... 7 is a magical number, and so that was hard to deal with. I think eventually you have to stop writing elegies, though. You can't weep on the world's shoulder forever.
Well, that's what I was coming on to, that in a way, talking like this could give one the wrong impression of the collection, I thought, because they don't feel... They are elegies in a certain sense, and yet they didn't seem to me, because there's so many things in them. There's a machine for grading kisses. There's a stolen reindeer. There's Edward Thomas translated into Japanese. There's a wonderful poem about an owl in a hotel room in London Bridge. I know London Bridge quite well. And there's a poem entitled The Royal Society for the Promotion of Loneliness. So there's a lot of jubilation. There's a lot of... there's a lot more. Not that so I was just interested by that mixture of there's loss, there's love. And there's this very unusual opening out into the imagination. I wonder whether you could say something about those influences of Spot. Those kind of things.
Yeah, I didn't want either books to be solid loss and grief because life is not all that one thing. Other things go on. So I wanted, and I hope in both books there's about half and half, and in this new one they're woven through. There's a few poems that are elegiac, a few poems about other things. I think one of the things about loss, you know, Peter died and then my dad died, and a very close friend of mine died in 2009, and it's something about, I mean, these are the worst things that could happen in many ways. You know, they are the worst things, and that's curiously liberating for the imagination, because this has happened and this has happened and this has happened. And you almost are forced to bounce to the other side where life is. So I think it's to do with making sure that one doesn't sink into a pit. I have been in the pit during the caring time and in the first year of bereavement. And it's not easy to get out of it. We get out of it. Having got out of it, I think you hang on to life, be it the stolen reindeer of life, I find a lot of things in life very curious and very funny.
I do find that
things intrigue and puzzle me, and I think as a poet you always have your radar out. So if you hear a weird story on the radio or overhear something weird in the street, you kind of follow it up with the imagination.
The other thing that I've noticed reading an interview with you for a while ago is that you've been saying how yoga and walking have had effect on you and on your poetry. You even say that in my poetry I give primacy to the breath. For me it's the way the poem breathes that gives it form. So I wondered whether you might say something about that.
Yeah, well, both Peter and I did do yoga. I mean, not in any expert way, but we stuck at it. And Peter certainly was had a strong dedication to pranayama, in that he did a very complex series of pranayama. In fact, after his own father died, he immediately plunged into a year of Iyengar's pranayama exercises. But when I'm drafting poems, I always read them aloud, and a lot of the time I'm using free verse, and I think the breath is a unit of measuring the way the poem's lines are falling right or wrongly. And if you kind of lose breath in a line or you stumble over it, I think inspiration, which happens in poetry, is of course the in-breath, exhalation, if you like, is the poem coming out into first draft, second draft, and so on. And walking, I find, because I live in Cornwall and we've got the coast path. I mean, Peter and I used to do a lot of our talking about the wise room by walking, and talking about poems, and one always thinks of how many pairs of sandals Dante wore out writing the Divine Comedy, as he did write on the hoof. I don't want to be trapped inside my head as a writer. You know, it has to do with this interest in the world, and it's to remember you have a body. You know, that there is inspiration and there's exhalation. And when you're walking, you know you have a body. And in meditation, we remember we have a body, and we focus on the breath. And I do, one of the things I found in coping with loss was I belonged to a small meditation group, insight meditation in Falmouth. Both Peter and I did. A very small group without a leader. That's also quite a support group. I mean, obviously people that have been through loss, people who have been through divorce and so on. So after meditation, we do have a time when we talk problems through. All of this is that we don't get stuck in the over-literary, I think. bodies in the world with our bodies and our senses.
Well, I was struck again in that interview you saying that meditative thinking is a strong foundation for dynamic thinking.
Yes.
So I was struck that you obviously have a sense that you even talk about mindfulness in
Very much not an expert who's just from our group, but I think probably one it's a form of mindfulness when one's writing, and although it's coming from one's mind, one is in a way absent, and language and imagination are there, and that's very liberating and freeing.
So the other thing I was going to get to, this is sort of a more difficult question to sort of form, but I was reminded reading Sandgren and Hourglass of something the cultural critic George Steiner wrote. I mean, I don't know whether you've read Steiner's book, Real Presences. It's incredibly difficult. I found it incredibly difficult to read. But one thing I could draw from it, he says that the great exemplars continue to ask the one question ineradicable in man: is there or is there not God? Is there or is there not meaning to being? So he's. One of his themes in Real Presences is that any art is really saying, is there or is there not meaning to being? And that's the great wager that any art form is really based on. And I felt there was something of that exploration in both of these volumes. There's a poem called Faust where you mention Christ's hands, for instance. But there's a sense I found in the poems where you're asking that question as well, is there or is there not meaning to being? I don't know whether that's how you think of it.
I think poems are very well suited to asking questions and not so much for finding answers. It is the formulation of the question, really, that sometimes is what is needed. But there are poems in there that have come out of meditative experience, and loss also, of course, sharpens up your desire to know more about spiritual realities.
Yes,
so it is part of it, but it's an enormously difficult and unquantifiable area. Language is a kind of mind detector, I think, for going through our lives and finding ways through whether to make our everyday lives bearable when we've been through very hard things, then to make them more rich and true to the person we are, but also they enable us perhaps to open doors into the spirit. But I don't know any answers. I just have the poems.
I just wonder, just to conclude.
I think Rilke, you know, that very first poem, he at first, when you're young, you think it's a love poem, he's yearning for a beloved, but he is saying, you know, where how can I be one with the spirit? I've always been frustrated, and that's the human situation, isn't it? We can't know, there isn't an answer. And we have to make various attempts at faith. So I suppose in Faust, the Christ's hands, I'm speaking in a secular way, but I'm looking at one stream of a spiritual reality. But it's questions rather than answers, I think.
And do you feel that's in your life, in your work? Do you feel that's what poetry has been for you, the kind of asking of questions and an exploration of experience?
It's just been the central thing for me. Sorry to say, I never really wanted to do anything else, so I had no career planned. It's really been everything, really, that has been central in my life. Language, whether reading other people's, or writing, or being in a place where people are on the same wavelength with poetry. It's just the way that I'm able to describe, define, and experience all realities, whether the realities of walking along Roman Road or whether they are spiritual realities and questions and searches and journeys. Wish I knew more.
That's a very, very good place to finish our interview. Thank you very much, Benedict.